Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the increasing likelihood that the U.S. and Iran will blunder into a war in the Gulf driven by a symbiosis between our hawks and their hawks, and an American president who has no credibility both in terms of diplomacy and in making a case against Iran's attacks on tankers. Joining us is Vali Nasser, the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We'll discuss his op-ed at the New York Times, "Trump might not want a war with Iran. Without diplomacy, he will get one." And the lack of credibility also shared by Trump's national security advisor Bolton and his Secretary of State Pompeo, and the skepticism among our allies about the case the Trump administration is trying to make against Iran over the attacks on the tankers. This in spite of the fact that it appears Iran is playing that dangerous card of attacking shipping as a way to drive up oil prices, to remind the U.S. and the Saudis that if Iran can't get their oil to market because of the economic warfare the United States is conducting against them, they can also shut down the Saudi oil output and one-third of the world's oil supply. With Iran days away from exceeding limits on uranium enrichment under the deal Trump tore up, as well as holding on to its supply of already enriched uranium that was supposed to be shipped out, another trigger for a war with Iran is waiting to be pulled. Then, with demonstrations continuing in Hong Kong against the government's extradition plan with the mainland that has been postponed but not cancelled, we will speak with Victoria Hoy, a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, who has worked in the democracy movement in Hong Kong and maintains the blog The Umbrella Movement and Beyond. She joins us to discuss what amounts to the largest demonstrations in modern history on a per capita basis, with 25% of Hong Kong's population rallying against Xi Jinping's encroachment on their freedoms guaranteed under the 1997 One Country, Two Systems deal. Then finally, with Egypt's only democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, dropping dead in a courtroom today as he defended himself against trumped-up espionage charges, we'll speak with Sarah Lee Whitson, the executive director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East Division. She joins us to discuss this terrible but predictable death just as Morsi was about to reveal secrets to the judge, and the report Human Rights Watch was compiling on his health and lack of medical attention the 67-year-old diabetic was getting since Morsi was not allowed family visits and proper food or medicine. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Vali Nasser, who is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran, and between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to Richard Holbrooke, the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, "Trump might not want war with Iran. Without diplomacy, he will get one." Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
So the problem clearly is coming back to haunt us, and that is President Trump's credibility problem. The Washington Post has compiled a list of over 10,000 lies since President Trump's been in office, and the Toronto Star has over 5,000 lies documented. Is this coming back to haunt us, do you think, in terms of our allies, whether or not they believe that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps was behind the attacks on the tankers?
Well, I mean, in this case, it's not actually just President Trump's credibility. In fact, more so is the credibility of his national security team. In other words, I think the reason that the world has difficulty accepting the United States at its word without evidence is because of John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and the belief that these figures would prefer regime change and war to negotiations. And because particularly Bolton was associated with fabrication of intelligence and information that led to the Iraq war. So it's not just President Trump. It's actually this time it's not what he says. It's but the people that he has chosen who also have credibility problem when it comes to initiating a war in a Middle Eastern country.
And in terms of President Trump's about face, which I suppose to his mind worked with North Korea. He started out with fire and fury, and there was genuine concern that there could be a nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula, and then he suddenly switched to exchanging love letters and praising the North Korean dictator. Do you think that kind of switch is working? I mean, particularly after the way that the Supreme Leader Khamenei treated the Japanese Prime Minister Abe, essentially humiliating him in public in a ambush television photo op in which he basically said, if you're kind of a messenger from Trump, I don't want to talk to Trump. So I'm not sure that the Iranians are listening when Trump says he wants a dialogue.
No, partly that the Supreme Leader may be a different person than Kim Jong-un, but there are differences between the two countries. One is that in North Korea, you have a single decision maker, no domestic politics, no free press. He can decide that the sun rises from the west and sets in the east if he decides to. Whereas Iran, although it's not a democracy, has a very sort of a open public press that can debate these things. The Supreme Leader cannot make about face without politicking, building consensus the way the North Korean leader could. And therefore, he's just as concerned about how Abe's trip to Iran would appear to his base and to the Iranian public than he is how it might appear to the outside. Secondly, North Korea has a nuclear weapon. Iran doesn't, which means that they have much more leverage in engaging Trump than the Iranians do. So the Iranians are very worried about going to the table without anything really to bargain over. Everything they had to bargain over on the nuclear field, they bargained with Obama already. And then they feel that, you know, the United States took all of that and now they don't have anything quite to bargain with. And thirdly, there is not an embedded sort of an anti-North Korea lobby in the United States as it exists vis-a-vis Iran. So the passions are run much higher about Iran on both because of the legacy of the hostage crisis and the Marine barracks bombing in Lebanon, but also because there's a very entrenched pro-Israel, pro-Saudi, pro-Arab lobby here that is dead against any kind of an opening between the United States and Iran. In East Asia, you have countries like China and South Korea that actually support a U.S. engagement with North Korea and are much more forward-leaning than the United States on North Korea. You don't have the equivalent of that in the Arab world, in a sense. So it's much more difficult to see how Iran and the United States are going to get to where North Korea and the United States got together. And also, in addition, North Korea went first. It was the love letters. There were two summits. Nothing came out of it. And the Iranians are watching that as well. And they're saying, well, you know, it was great. They talked. But other than a photo opportunity, what did the North Koreans get? So they're much more gun-shy here.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Nasser, who's the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. And his books include The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. But there is some leverage, it would seem, that Iran has. And that is, if these attacks on tankers, as they have already done, raise the price of oil, that is something that Donald Trump doesn't want, particularly as this election cycle gets underway. He doesn't want the price of oil to rise, and that would seem to be some leverage on the part of the Iranians. I know they also benefit from a higher price of oil in spite of the sanctions. They still manage to get some oil out. I'm not sure how it's done, perhaps smuggling through Iraq. But is that a factor?
Well, I mean, the amount of oil they're getting out is increasingly diminishing and indefinitely is not enough to sustain their economy at a level that they would like. So they are under a lot of pressure. And you're correct. The only leverage Iran right now has is actually to threaten disruption of the world economy, the flow of oil, causing trouble in the Persian Gulf region, as well as threatening that they're going to restart their nuclear program and they're going to leave the nuclear deal. I mean, in some ways, the United States has had best of both worlds, which is that Iran for 2 years has been abiding by the deal, and yet the United States has been punishing it in order to get a better deal. And I think the Iranians are starting to say that these are the only two things that we can basically threaten the U.S. So if the U.S. doesn't want to go to war, if it doesn't want tanker wars, if it doesn't want disruption of oil and higher oil prices, and if the U.S. does not want to deal with an Iran that is, again, enriching and would be much closer to a bomb than it's been in the past 2-3 years, then it has to sort of ease on the pressure that it's putting on Iran. So that's actually the kind of signaling negotiation, if you would, that is going on between them.
But isn't the countdown for this renewed round of tensions with Iran, with these renewed sanctions involving cutting off their access to international currency transactions via SWIFT, can't you trace it all to Trump tearing up the JCPOA? I mean, it seems logical to me that this is a country undergoing economic warfare. In effect, the United States has declared economic warfare on Iran, much worse, I think, than the sanctions, or at least as bad as the sanctions that led to Iran making the JCPOA deal or the P5+1 deal. So, you know, if you look at historical analogies, I know they're not particularly helpful, but the Japanese, before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. cut off oil supplies. They had about 6 months of oil reserves. They decided that they had to take the oil fields in Sumatra and Brunei, and thus we had Pearl Harbor. Now, I'm not making excuses for the Japanese nor for the Iranians, but it seems that on our side, we're not really focusing on the extent to which we are already, under the Trump administration, engaged in economic warfare. And if the Iranians, as it looks like they're signaling, they're going to, first of all, their fissile material that they were supposed to ship out, the stuff that they've already enriched, they haven't shipped out. And secondly, they're now saying that they may go over the threshold of the limits that they've agreed to on enriched uranium. So we could have a second trigger, if you will, worse than the tanker war trigger.
That's right, without a doubt. I mean, yes, the economic sanctions are economic warfare, and after a point, it becomes an existential threat to a government, and therefore then it's going to defend itself and fight for survival, and that becomes unpredictable about how they might fight for survival, and that creates a danger. But there's no doubt that, look, good or bad, President Obama arrived at a nuclear deal with Iran that froze Iran's progress towards a greater amount of nuclear material and towards the bomb. The international community, International Atomic Agency, they all ascertained that regardless of what Iran's ultimate intentions might be, for now, its program has slowed down and it's not progressing very far. And there was certain stability in U.S.-Iran relations. So Trump has basically taken a situation that was fairly stable when he came in, although it was not ideal. It was not ideal by any stretch of imagination, but it was stable and has destabilized it and has brought it to the brink of war. And right now, I don't think he has a game plan about how is he going to manage it. So, yes, the United States is more powerful. Yeah, it can go to war with Iran. It would be devastating for Iran. But as we saw in Iraq or Afghanistan, these wars are no longer that easy for the United States. And it's extremely risky for the U.S. to go the next step and go to war with Iran. And it's not very clear how Trump plans to climb down from the ladder. How is he going to take a situation that he's destabilized back to stability? And at the same time, his advisors actually are still in the mold of the Iraq war. They're still thinking regime change. They're still thinking about militarily dislodging the Islamic Republic, of somehow Iran becoming a democratic state immediately. And And therefore, the thinking within the administration, I think, is not quite attuned to the level of danger that is actually out there.
Well, it seems to me that the genesis of this crisis goes back to the cancellation of the JCPOA along with the Paris Accords and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, of course, has benefited China immensely. China's rolling back the clock in terms of any liberalization within the country under Xi Jinping. And I think you can make that case that that's been a gift, in effect, to Chinese reactionaries, as indeed cancelling the JCPOA was a gift to the Iranian hardliners. There's sort of a symbiosis, that you could argue, between Bolton, Pompeo, and the IRGC and Khamenei. And it's all to do with Trump's obsession with undoing anything and everything that Obama achieved. So I guess to answer your question, Trump has to come to terms with his obsession over Obama, one, and two, let me ask you this, Valinasa. Do you think Khamenei, the supreme leader, is capable or able to cry uncle?
Is always theoretically yes, but it's you know, we don't know what the probability of that is. And even to get to talks, you still have to have a pathway of negotiating. I mean, absolute surrender is not likely. That's the least likely scenario. So even if you're going to have get the Iranians to negotiate seriously, you still have to engage in some kind of a give and take with them. And I think therefore, there's a step between having put so much pressure to get the supreme leader's attention and actually getting to the talks that requires a skillful diplomacy.
Well, it would seem to me that there is a precedent, of course, with the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, who did make the deal to end the Iraq war, which he described to as being the equivalent to drinking poison. So is that a useful analogy?
Well, it will help. I mean, when the moment comes that Iran would have to take a hard decision that it was not prepared to do, has to sell this to its public, I think the example of Khomeini and drinking poison will always be helpful. But I don't think the Iran's leadership is convinced that it is there, or that actually getting engaged with Trump is going to be any better than resisting him. I think the next phase, whether it's the next week or the next month, is going to be very critical in terms of whether this will begin go down the path of some form of engagement, or that we're going to see the current standoff actually collapse into outright conflict.
Well, the hawks on our side, I know that there were reports a little while back that Bolton had ordered war plans involving, I think, 200,000 U.S. troops. Any kind of military decapitation, regime decapitation, would involve the deaths of the military, and I can't imagine that the Iranian people would not rally around the flag if the country's under attack. So the idea that you want to get rid of this regime and bring about regime change could only be done by the Iranian people themselves. And I don't see how people suffering under economic deprivation, even though they hate this regime, we know that. We know that the young people particularly are sick of it, of this theocratic kleptocracy. But if you look at countries like Venezuela or Zimbabwe, you can have terrible governments that are mismanaging the economy in a chronic way, as is the case with decades of deprivation in Zimbabwe under dictatorships, which have, you know, the new guy, the crocodiles, is just as bad as the old guy, Mugabe. And then in Venezuela, the U.S., or at least the Trump administration, are trying to gin up a revolution or a counter-revolution against Maduro. But the people are tired, they're deprived, they have no food, no medicine, and that's starting to happen in Iran. So does that analogy work in a sense that you can't expect regime change and people to rise up when they're absolutely demoralized? And furthermore, if the United States uses military force, they're going to turn around and support their own government. As much as they don't like their government, they're still going to support it.
Well, I'm not sure about the demoralization part, but there definitely the nationalism and rallying to the flag is there. But you know, the reality of it is that there are a lot of things about Iran that are dissimilar. And we frankly don't know that if the Islamic Republic were to collapse, which direction would it fall and what would replace it? I think the least likely scenario is that somehow that it would very quickly just become, in an Eastern European fashion, become a westernized democracy. You know, there's an Iraq or a Libya scenario likely. There's the scenarios like you mentioned in Zimbabwe or Venezuela of one dictator being replaced by another one is possible. But we really don't know that if the Islamic Republic in control in Iran were to lose its grip, how does the regime unravel? Whether we end up with a much larger country of instability that would become even a greater danger to regional peace than the Islamic Republic is, or we're going to end up relatively quickly with a much better situation. But we can imagine that war makes a smooth transition to something better much, much less likely. I think the pathway that the Iran nuclear deal showed, namely gradually opening up the regime through engagement, would have been a better way of thinking about how Iran could evolve over time into somewhere better, that a new middle class, a new generation, much more vested in its relationship with the West, would take over from the hardliners and the first generation of the revolution that has ruled the country. But now, in a condition of war and confrontation, it's the hard voices, it's the military, it's the security forces that are on the forefront. And if it comes to war, the result will be instability.
Well, just in closing, the former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, once said that the Saudis want the United States to fight Iran to the last American. And I don't understand why we don't sort of pull back a little bit and look at who's really the bad actor here, in terms of at least there's some vestiges of democracy in Iran. There are elections, albeit controlled by the supreme leader, who gets to pick the candidates. But there's still, as you pointed out, there's still civil society there, and I guess a form of political Islam. In Saudi Arabia, there's nothing. There's just a reactionary regime, a reactionary monarchy with absolute power, holding power via an even more reactionary religious establishment that spread an extremely divisive and xenophobic form of Islam around the world. It's created enormous problems. It's still the major sponsor of international terrorism, Saudi Arabia, in terms of what it spawned with the Taliban, with Al-Qaeda, and with the Islamic State. And now they're trying to stop the democratic aspirations of the Sudanese people. It's the Saudis and the Emiratis who were supporting these murderous military, because they're in part because they're working as mercenaries in fighting this terrible war that's going on in Yemen. Do you think we'll have a national debate about who we're supporting and who we're fighting here?
No, the short answer is no. I don't think we will.
And why not?
Just because, you know, it's up to the press and our politicians to do that, and there is no appetite for it.
Because what? Because of money? Because of oil?
Because of habit? Because also sometimes Iran makes itself more of a problem than
sure.
The Saudis do.
Well, death to America is not particularly helpful.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate
the Thank you. Your time. Thanks for inviting me.
And again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasser, who's the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. And between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to Richard Holbrooke, the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, "Trump might not want war with Iran without diplomacy. He will get one." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the demonstrations continuing in Hong Kong against the government's extradition plan with the mainland that has been postponed but not cancelled. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Victoria Hoy, who is a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, where her research examines the dynamics of international politics and state-society relations in historical China and historical Europe. She's the author of War and State Formation in Ancient China and Early Modern Europe, and has worked in the democracy movement in Hong Kong and maintains the blog The Umbrella Movement and Beyond. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victoria Hoy.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Victoria. And of course, the demonstrations continue in Hong Kong. You know, Carrie Lam backed down on the extradition deal with the mainland, which the Hong Kong people rightly saw as a way that the Chinese could start disappearing dissidents as opposed to arresting criminals. But why, after she's backed down, are these demonstrations continuing?
Well, most of all, is that because she only promised to set it aside, suspend it for some time without a concrete timetable. But she would not completely withdraw the bill. And just yesterday, that the Beijing's liaison office in Hong Kong just sent another message that, well, we are not going to completely retract it. We're just basically taking a break, maybe hopefully that we can stop the momentum of the protest. And another reason why people were all pouring into the street, then the size of the demonstration on the second Sunday almost double the demonstration of the previous Sunday, was that people got really outraged by the police use of massive force, using rubber bullets for the first time, because the last time in 2014, they already used tear gas. But this time they used tear gas, pepper gas, rubber bullets, and also beanbags. And people just got very upset. And also the government and the police called what happened on Wednesday a riot. And people demand that that understanding of the protest on Wednesday should be retracted as well.
So is this to say then, you know, right opposite the parliament, there's that big building of the PRC, it's the former British garrison, where there's lots of mainland Chinese intelligence officers, etc. Have the mainland Chinese essentially taken over the police, the Hong Kong police?
People are circulating this rumor that some of these riot police, when they were speaking, they did not sound like Hong Kong people. But there's no proof. We cannot really prove that. And also, of course, the government would not tell us that. They said, no, there's nothing like that. But it is also very curious that a lot of these riot police, they do not have the name. They do not have the number. Typically, most normal policemen should have that number and on the shoulder. And so it's very difficult to even track down who these people are. At the same time, though, some people also took videos of just Hong Kong sounding police forces laughing and joking about having so much fun and shooting people. So some of them are really Hong Kong people, and some of them we don't know. And to what extent that Beijing has already infiltrated the security forces is something that's very hard to know. In general, that they've infiltrated in different parts and doing political work, but whether they have also served as police forces is hard to tell.
Well, the New York Times is carrying a front page story on Monday about how these protests in Hong Kong have rattled Xi Jinping, who is in Tajikistan, having a birthday celebration with Vladimir Putin. What do you think of those reports?
Well, I suppose the Hong Kong people gave him a really nice birthday present by just demonstrating in the street. And because also Hong Kong people do not believe Carrie Lam saying that this is all her own idea, that this is not Beijing ordering her to do something like this, pushing through the extradition bill. So, well, now that Carrie Lam is forced to suspend the bill, this is definitely seen as a defeat for Xi Jinping. But at the same time, obviously, they are going to just tighten the screw on Hong Kong as well. So the question is, how much more they're going to do, given what they've done in the past 5 years since the end of the Umbrella Movement? They disqualified legislators. They refused visa to a Financial Times reporter. They also kidnapped booksellers who were publishing books critical of Chinese leaders. Given that they've done all of those things in order to silence Hong Kong, to really rein in Hong Kong over the past 5 years, and after this much bigger protest, there's no questions that they're going to continue to really step up the gear to rein in Hong Kong. But then Hong Kong people will continue to fight back too, because they have nowhere to go when the firewall, the last pillar of freedom of Hong Kong's independent judiciary, is broken down when Hong Kong people can be extradited back to China. So they will just keep fighting back.
So is there a concern on Xi Jinping's part that this infection of democracy will spread from Hong Kong to the mainland? I mean, they've done a very good job of squelching the memory of Tiananmen, which, of course, is alive. The memory is alive in Hong Kong. But after Tiananmen, the Chinese Communist Party essentially encouraged nationalism and materialism amongst the young Chinese. I'm wondering, first of all, because of censorship, they're probably not getting any information, are they? Or maybe they are getting information. So what's your take on that? Because that seems to me to be the only hope, because Xi Jinping has turned back the clock in terms of empowering the Communist Party, bringing back a kind of Maoism. He's much less pragmatic than his predecessors were. And, you know, he's got a free rein since Trump canceled the TPP. He's been emboldened. And, of course, Trump is such a disastrous, incompetent leader that he's kind of a gift to Xi Jinping in any case. So what's your sense of whether there's any possibility that the pro-democracy movement in the mainland could be revived or stimulated or inspired by what's going on in Hong Kong?
Okay. The first question is that, as you said, the CCP has been very successful at creating amnesia of Tiananmen. And most mainland Chinese, even when they know about it, they follow the party line. Yeah, those are rioters. And of course, it is correct to crack them down. Otherwise, China would not have enjoyed this economic takeoff over the last 30 years. And in fact, also, in 1989, when the student movement broke out in Beijing and across China, Hong Kong people pour into the street to support students in China, in Beijing, pouring tons of money and material support. Because the idea was that Hong Kong is going to be returned to China. If China becomes democratic, then we'll be fine. But if the dictatorship continues, then we'll be in trouble. So the idea at the time was today's Tiananmen, tomorrow's Hong Kong. Now, given that China has been so successful in suppressing Tiananmen, and so then at the same time, Hong Kong is the only place on Chinese territory where people continue to commemorate June 4th every single year. The CCP is trying to, actually since 1989, has been trying to make Hong Kong safe for the CCP. And in order to do that, this is why they've been trying to erode the any differences between the two systems under the one country, two systems model. Now, in that sense, it is true. It does really look like there is not much hope for democratic reforms in China. But then in the end, a lot of Hong Kong people these days have given up the idea that Hong Kong can be saved only when China becomes a democracy. This is why people are just fighting on their own. And then I would say that the idea is very well captured by a Joshua Wong documentary, Teenager Versus Superpower. When all the Western capitals were all kowtowing to Beijing, Hong Kong people have been really the only groups still standing up to challenge Beijing's will.
But you don't see then a possibility of even a return to the more pragmatic leadership of Xi Jinping's predecessors, or is he going to be successful in turning back the clock, reviving Maoism and making him, Uncle Xi, the leader for life?
Yeah, if Xi Jinping meets with more and more hurdles, there is some chance that the more pragmatic among the core leadership may then turn against him. And it seems that the only likely scenario that would happen is when China's economy really hits a wall. And it is possible that given what Xi Jinping has been doing, essentially starting a trade war with the U.S., not that, you know, Trump doesn't carry some of the blame, but also that even another news that came out last week in Hong Kong is that a lot of big businesses are pulling the money out of Hong Kong because they're very worried that the money is no longer safe. When the extradition law is passed, the mainland authorities could request Hong Kong banks to freeze the suspect's assets. And this is something very worrisome. And so there is some danger that Hong Kong's economy and the property markets, the stock markets will crash along with China's. And that would be bad for Hong Kong. But at the same time, that could open up the opportunity that for people, the more pragmatic voices, to say, Mr. Xi Jinping, you seem to have pushed too far. It's time to just correct our direction. That would be the best hope that I can think of.
I see. Well, just in closing, it's historic what's happening in Hong Kong. If you take the percentage of the protests on a per capita basis, 25% of Hong Kong's population have come out over the last week and the weekends to protest the extradition law. Proportionally, that is the biggest protest in modern history.
Yes, in terms of per capita, because there were probably way more people in China in 1989. There were probably more people in Egypt around Tahrir Square in 2011. But in terms of per capita, yes, no doubt. And even in 2014, there was a Chinese university study just polling people, and then they projected that at least 1.2 million people went to the protest site or doing something to support the umbrella movement in one form or another. So this time, the previous Sunday, over 1 million people, and the past Sunday, yesterday, 2 million people. So essentially, we are really talking about doubling the size. And to a large extent, it's because all the business leaders who used to be against democracy, who used to do, okay, whatever, you know, Beijing doesn't want, so long as it doesn't hurt my pocket, it's fine. All these people have also come out.
Well, I thank you. I hope that democracy survives, and even more, I hope that it influences the mainland. But I very much appreciate you joining us here today, Victoria Hoi.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Victoria Hoi, who's a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, where her research examines the dynamics of international politics and state-society relations in historic China and historic Europe. She's the author of War and State Formation in Ancient China and Early Modern Europe, and has worked in the democracy movement in Hong Kong and maintains the blog The Umbrella Movement and Beyond. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the causes today behind the sudden death of Egypt's only democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Lee Whitson, who's Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Lee Whitson.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Sarah. And Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's only elected leader, who only served for 1 year before the military ousted him and put him in prison on espionage charges. His sudden death today in the courtroom in a caged witness cage, I guess. He'd made a 5-minute remarks and then apparently died of a stroke. We don't quite know. But your organization, you've tweeted out that Morsi's death was terrible but entirely predictable given the government's failure to allow him adequate medical care, much less family visits. And apparently Human Rights Watch are in the midst of finalizing a report on Morsi's health when he suddenly died. So what can you tell us about what's in the report that you're working on his health now that he has passed?
Well, sadly, it was really an amplification of the findings that we issued 2 years ago on the inhumane conditions of his detention. It's now been 6 years since he had been arrested and jailed. And in that period of time, President Morsi had been allowed 3 family visits, none lasting more than half an hour in 6 years, which is starkly different from even the limited family visits that other Egyptian prisoners get, typically monthly visits, in some cases weekly visits. So he was singled out for mistreatment, singled out for this sort of abusive conduct. And most significantly, in addition to being held in solitary confinement in a cell room that didn't even have a bed, which is what he said, he was denied adequate medical care. He repeatedly asked to be taken to a hospital, repeatedly asked to have specialized medical checkups, specialized medical treatment because he was a diabetic, because he suffered from complications related to his diabetes, and the government continued to refuse this. Indeed, from what we understand, he had a nurse or a doctor coming occasionally to administer insulin to him, but providing him with no other medical treatment, you know, taking his blood pressure and whatnot. But denying him the medical treatment that he sought. And he had lost a great deal of weight in prison because he also didn't have access to food provided by his family. Other prisoners in Egypt regularly, typically have their families bringing in food for them. But in President Morsi's case, his family was not allowed to do that. It's entirely predictable because when you deprive someone who's ill, who has health problems, who's a diabetic, and you keep him in these conditions for as long as they did, they're going to die.
Well, he was 67 years old, and if he was a diabetic, Sarah, he would need a special diet, and insulin is not enough. Diabetics have to be monitored constantly.
Yes, that's true, and of course that's what he kept reminding the court anytime he was able to see a judge. He pleaded for medical attention, not even focusing on the details of the case against him, but just the basic conditions of his detention. And the government deliberately ignored him. They deliberately singled him out for this kind of brutal treatment.
So what was the basis, not that one expects under a military dictatorship like the one that President Sisi runs in Egypt, who of course deposed Morsi in 2013 after he'd been elected and only served for a year, what is the at least this trumped up charge of espionage? How could an elected head of state be charged with espionage? Not that it's not a possibility here with Donald Trump and his relationship with Putin, but I'm curious to know what at least the Egyptian authorities have come up with as a justification for this charge.
Well, if far as we understand, the charges related to his communications with the Hamas government and the Iranian government, which, as you note, is, you know, somewhat ludicrous. As a head of state, obviously he's going to communicate with governments in the region, particularly the neighboring government of Hamas in Gaza, with which it was essential that they coordinate because they share a land border that President Morsi wanted to see more regularly opened in order to relieve the conditions of the Palestinians there. He was also accused of things that pass as crimes in Egypt, such as insulting the judiciary. That's something he was actually sentenced to jail for. And he was sentenced in connection with a protest that occurred outside the presidential palace, a violent protest that left almost 12 people dead. 8 supporters of President Morsi were killed in that protest, and 3 opponents to President Morsi were killed in that protest. President Morsi was barricaded inside, and security forces were unable to prevent the violence. But this is something that President Morsi was blamed for in terms of the killings of the opponents of President Morsi.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Lee Whitson, who's Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division. And we're talking about the sudden death today of Mohamed Morsi, a member of Egypt's largest Islamic group, the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. He was the first democratically elected president of Egypt in 2012, and the military ousted him in 2013 after massive protests. And it would seem that what is really going on here, the subtext, is Saudi Arabia played a role with supporting the military coup against this elected Muslim Brotherhood government. There is obviously a sort of battle in the Middle East going on between the monarchs who rule with absolute power, the Gulf monarchs, and any effort at democratization in the Middle East, in any sort of form, loosely called political Islam. And the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, is considered a representative of political Islam, as I suppose you could argue the Iranian government as well is a form of political Islam. But the absolute monarchs with absolute power who don't want any vestiges or even any hint of democracy are well-financed and they've been very effective. So I suppose it's not a surprise that the people that are coming forward now to praise the late Muslim Brotherhood leader are Erdogan of Turkey and the Hamas leaders. So do you see that as a subtext, Sarah Lee Whitson, that this is really about political Islam and the extent to which it's under attack by these Gulf monarchies?
Absolutely. Although I would emphasize that the Gulf monarchies are opposed to any democracy of any kind. I think it's important to note that President Sisi has directed his vengeance and attacks against Egypt's secular opposition, the secular opposition that was largely behind the 2011 revolution, as well as artists, writers, singers, dancers, intellectuals, musicians. The real enemy of these people is democracy. The real enemy of these monarchs are their own people. They don't want them to have a voice. They don't want them to be represented. And the fact that they're Islamist only heightens the threat and the feeling of threat that these monarchies feel, because they also take away one bone of their legitimacy, which is that they are somehow Islamic, if not Islamist. And so to have a democratic government and one that has legitimacy not only in their popular vote but in representing and speaking for a religious culture in their country, a conservative religious culture in the country, is a double legitimacy threat to these monarchies.
Well, isn't there a substantial population? I mean, isn't a substantial percentage of the Egyptian population supports the Muslim Brotherhood? I just don't know now how you do any accurate polling, but it does seem that the military have always, you know, at least in the post-war period, have dominated Egyptian politics. But as we talked about earlier, the Tahrir Square was a democratic opening, largely led by the secular opposition, and they've all been crushed. There was, of course, I think in many ways, the Egyptian military manipulated the secular opposition through Temerod to oust Morsi, but then they turned on everybody, did they not? Both the secular and the religious opposition. So do you have any idea of what percentage of the population supports Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, and obviously this is clearly a minority rule going on in Egypt by the people who've always been in power, and frankly, our former government of Obama kept ties with them, although they did make some noises about human rights. But Trump seems to be, along with the Saudis, are absolutely blindly in support of Sisi.
You've got a couple of questions in there. First, in terms of the support for the Freedom and Justice Party or the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, obviously they have a great deal of support. But I think that President Sisi's election victory, which was a runoff, you know, first it was four candidates, then it was a runoff between two, gave him a very narrow margin of victory. And I wouldn't say that everybody voted for him, who gave him a majority, were necessarily voting because they supported the Muslim Brotherhood. Many, many people voted for President Morsi because they liked the person running against him, Ahmed Shafiq, even less because he represented the Ancien Regime. He represented the Mubarak government. He served as the prime minister under Mubarak. And so they were choosing, in their view, the lesser of two evils. It's also not clear whether President Morsi would have won the next election or the next election after that, or whether the Muslim Brotherhood remained popular. And what the Egyptian people have been deprived of is an opportunity to work out their own politics, to allow the pendulum to swing one way and then another, and then have it self-correct from what the people learn they want and learn what they don't want. We in the United States are having a very painful experience in choosing leaders that very large numbers of us don't like. That alone can't be a reason for overthrowing a democratically elected government.
Well, I recall at the time, it seems like behind the scenes, the military manipulated these elections that led to Morsi's election, that in effect they wanted him because there really wasn't anybody. You mentioned the shill for the Mubarak regime, but there wasn't really a representative of the secular opposition, the very leaders or the spark for the Tahrir Square democratic uprising that led to the elections in the first place. Is my memory correct on that, Sarah?
Well, I mean, there was certainly secular opposition parties, but the reality is they just didn't have a lot of popular support in terms of voters throughout the country. Mm-hmm. The revolution was very much a Cairo movement, and like most public protests, you know, will involve many of the most educated young participants that don't necessarily represent the majority of electorates. You have to remember that the Muslim Brotherhood had been opening and providing free medical assistance, free schooling, free tutors, free financial assistance to families all over Egypt through their social service networks, and had a very strong base of support. That's not to say that there weren't candidates who were potentially also very strong candidates against President Morsi, but like Abdel Fattah, who ran against them as a former Muslim Brotherhood member. But ultimately, they had the strongest support. Might that have changed over time? Possibly. Might there have been a greater shift to secular politics? Possibly. But that's exactly the problem and the issue, is that the people in the Arab world and the people of Egypt are not given a chance to choose their own politics. There's always outside meddling, nefarious interests. Why was the Egyptian military so strong so as to be able to overthrow this elected government? It's had billions of dollars of support from the U.S. government for decades, and it had the direct financial assistance and support of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. It wasn't up to the Egyptian people.
Sure, and the UAE and Saudi sabotaged the Morsi government. They withdrew oil supplies and money to make life miserable, depriving the Egyptian people of food and energy, which led to the Tamarud organization, which I think was a military front. I think the secular people were manipulated by the military, and of course then Sisi came to power, was welcome in effect, and now he's just imprisoned, I don't know what numbers of people. I mean, how many people are in jail? I mean, it's an extraordinary purge that's gone on under Sisi, has it not, of both the religious and secular opposition?
Absolutely, and it's very hard to give precise numbers now, but at some point we had a tally of about 50,000 Muslim Brothers who had been jailed and detained in Egypt following the coup and the wide-scale arrests that took place. You know, many of those have been released, but there are new people have been arrested. We have roughly estimated, without an ability to do on-the-ground research, without real ability to document the actual numbers, that at least 30,000 remain imprisoned. There have also been a number of executions. There have been numerous deaths in custody. We've documented extreme torture in Egyptian prisons. So the conditions are by far the worst that we've ever documented in Egypt.
Well, next door in Sudan, we've seen another popular uprising and the removal of the long military dictator, Omar Bashir. But it does look as though the military are maintaining power. There's been a terrible crackdown on the democratic opposition in their protest camp across from military headquarters. There was a massacre. Now they've even used the Janjaweed militia as an enforcement tool. But one of the things that's not, and of course there was some press coverage suggesting that the Sudanese democracy movement may have some spillover effect on Egypt. Certainly at the time there were allusions to Tahrir Square made to the movement, these pro-democracy movements in Sudan, who successfully ousted the dictator, only to find that the dictator's enforcers are now firmly in control. But what's going on behind the scenes? Again, we go back to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. They are the ones that support the military government in Sudan. They are using Sudanese military mercenaries in this terrible war that they're prosecuting in Yemen. I'm astounded that the American people don't get the picture of exactly what Saudi Arabia is up to and how much they are actively dedicated to squelching any kind of democracy in the Middle East. And it's so evident that that's exactly what's happening in Sudan.
Well, I mean, it's absolutely true. And sadly, the American public has regularly been asleep when the nefarious conduct of America's allies, or sometimes its home government, is at play outside its borders. I think Americans have a much better record, not a great one, but a better one, of being awake to injustices within our country, but sadly not nearly as focused on what's happening outside the country in terms of the military assistance, the military participation of the U.S. in the war in Yemen, which has now been going on for almost 4 years. This is not just about arms sales to Saudi Arabia. It's the fact that the United States is actually a party to the war, has been providing targeting assistance from the very beginning, from even under the Obama administration's time. And I think the real test that's coming now for the American people is whether they're going to be led by the leash into a war with Iran. I mean, we're seeing this unfold in front of our eyes right now. And everyone who was around during the second Gulf War and said never again, will never be sold a cheap bag of lies and lead us into war, disaster for our own country, you know, exponential disaster for the Iraqi people. That's exactly what's happening now with Iran. And, you know, there's little bleats of protest and discussion and debate among, you know, those who are focused on foreign policy issues in the media. But beyond that, I'm not hearing a massive outcry.
Well, Sarah Lee Whitson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Lee Whitson, who's the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. And she's led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
wine with the man she loves.